recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Welcome back, everybody, and this week on this Memorial Day episode of Infamous Indy, we look at how the Ku Klux Klan was taken down here in the Hoosier State. Now, one definition of memorial is something designed to preserve the memory of a person or an event. Now, I looked that up because I want you to pay attention to that this episode. We're paying tribute to one of the bravest women to ever stand up to her offender. She lost her life because of it, but she also changed history. She took down major Ku Klux Klan member that you'll hear about. His name is D.C. Stevenson. So it's only fitting that we remember her on this Memorial Day. In my interview this week is a good friend of mine, an indie local historian, Al Hunter. Al and I met when I was a reporter. I wanted to do a story about his Indiana or in Irvington ghost tours over in Irvington, Indiana. And if you don't know about those tours, they're amazing. Honestly, go out and try them out. They happen every October, and you can go on the website. He'll tell you about it in the episode, but I contacted him for that, and I did a story about the Irv, the theater in Irvington, where he starts these ghost tours. And what's interesting about that theater is the stage underneath was the stage at Market Square Arena. So, like, they just picked it up and moved it when it was Market Square Arena was being demolished. For anybody who doesn't know, Market Square Arena was the home of the Pacers before Bankers Life Fieldhouse. So they literally took the stage and moved it to the Irv. Now, the Irv is still standing. You can go in there. But that stage was one of the last places that Elvis ever performed. In fact, I believe it's the last place that Elvis ever performed. One of his last shows was on the stage at Market Square Arena. Al is also a former baseball coach, high school baseball coach. He loves to write for the Irvington free newspaper called The Weekly View. In fact, you can just go online and Google some of his articles. And when you land on the homepage, look to the right. There's Al. He's sitting there with his smile on and his IU hat. He always wears that hat like a true Hoosier. He actually wore it during our interview as well. Over the past few years, Al and I have spent time working on different projects together. He brought me into this place. It's called Pogue's Run. It's a tunnel under the city. Literally, it's like a 3-mile tunnel under the city. And it was, some people believe it's very haunted, but Al and I are paranormally challenged. And I stole that directly from him, by the way, that paranormally challenged saying. I wasn't really that scared, but it is not necessarily a safe place to go. So it's good to go for big group. So if you want to see that, I did that story for wishtv.com, and I know that one's online, so you can kind of search that one called Pogue's Run, the history of Pogue's Run. Anyway, anytime I get to call him or work with him, he either knows the answer or knows somebody who knows the answer. So I just can't thank him enough for being a part of this. He's going to be a big part of this podcast. You know, that's one of my things with these older cases. I'm not going to have people to talk to, so who best to talk about it than someone who studies it and looks up the facts and is obsessed with it, because that's literally what Al is. He's obsessed with the history. Just to give you an idea of where some of his articles or what some of his articles' titles are, The Life and Death of John Dillinger's Red Hamilton. Red Hamilton was one of his cohorts, the John Dillinger gang, parts 1 and 2. Paul is Dead, meaning Paul McCartney. So, like, kind of looking into that. And then Coughing Up Bullets, A Civil War Tale for the Ages. Those are just some of his recent articles that are up right now if you go to the Weekly Views website. Now, Al's true passion lies with Abraham Lincoln. We recorded this podcast at his home. I sat inside his office and surrounded me during the podcast Literally, I couldn't keep my eyes off the walls because everything is filled with anything Lincoln. And I don't mean kitschy fake memorabilia from gift shops. I mean like actual Lincoln artifacts that deserve to be in a museum. Like some of the most interesting things I've ever seen or ever really been up near in my life. I've been to museums all over the world, and this was insane. It blew my mind. I mean, there was literally a handwritten note from Lincoln and Lincoln's Bible. I just don't know how much cooler you can get than that. So his love for the 16th president is no doubt immense. But that's the kind of passion I love about Al, and that's why I invited him to join me. It definitely won't be his first episode, like I said. So, you know, he's a wealth of knowledge, and just be excited that he's going to be joining me on a regular here for this podcast. Now, this time we focus on D.C. Stevenson. He's a brute of a man who tortured and killed a young woman. We don't know how many he actually did that to. It could have been multiple, but for this episode, we're just talking about Madge Oberholzer. And you'll hear her story coming up. Madge was a bright, smart young lady who should be remembered for what she did. She took down one of these most powerful men in the world. Al and I kind of avoided the graphic parts of the story. I could tell that, you know, this probably didn't need it. They're really bad. But essentially, just to kind of give you an overview, D.C. Stevenson bit Madge to the point of killing her. It was horrific, even a century later, because it happened in 1925. It is just horrendous, but you can read it if you want. Just go online, just be aware it's pretty graphic. But like I always tell you guys and anybody who listens to these podcasts, it's important that we try to learn something from these details. So not just talk about the terrible things that happened, but what can we do to stop it even to this day? What can we learn from Madge Oberholzer 100 years later? So please enjoy the episode. Thanks for joining me. I'm just so excited that I continue to do this every other week for you guys, because for me, it's an adventure. And I do have the next episode lined up, ready to go, so make sure to stay tuned. And stay tuned after the interview for a little information about some events coming up here in Indianapolis. And with that said, everybody, enjoy the interview. Welcome, everybody, to the Infamous Indy Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. And with me today, as we sit amongst some of the most interesting artifacts in history that have to do with Lincoln, I'm sitting across from Al Hunter. He's a local historian here in Indiana. And as you all know, with my podcast, one of the most important things for me is to get the people who know the most, if not involved with crimes or history of crimes, vice versa. Today, you are my first historian, Al. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for asking.
Yeah, of course. And you and I are friends.
Oh, yeah.
We've become friends over the last couple of years. As a reporter, we met through just one of my stories, really, about the Irving Theater. But more specifically, it was your Irvington Ghost Tours.
Ghost Tours, yeah. Yeah, and you like to hang out with old guys every once in a while, so I fit the bill.
You do. With this case today, I kind of went over a little bit in my intro what we're going to be talking about, but you have a real opportunity here to talk about things that you don't talk about on your ghost tour. You and I say this, I stole this from you, and people have heard me say this before, that I am paranormally challenged. I stole it directly from you, so don't make no mistake, I'm not that smart to come up with that term.
It explains it, though, doesn't it?
It does. I've never had anything happen to me specifically. I'm not opposed to something happening and believing that that person happened, but for me specifically, I mean, I was in Herb Baumeister's house doing almost seance-like stuff, and nothing happened to me. One of the most haunted places, definitely, in Indiana.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I've been on your tour a couple times there in October. You do an incredible job.
Every Friday and Saturday in October, 7 o'clock, you'll find us at Johnson Avenue outside Irvington Masonic Lodge 666. So that's where we're at.
You also are really just enthralled with Irvington. And this is where our story with D.C. Stevenson takes place. It really is surrounding Irvington area, which is very interesting. And what we'll get into here is how come somebody who was so high up with the Ku Klux Klan was in an area like Irvington where they were definitely more on the left as we would call it now,
yeah,
on the left.
They weren't a conservative community. And Stevenson ended up in Irvington. Irvington, it has a high Catholic population, always has an active Catholic population, and that's what he ended up in Irvington for. Was you obviously equate the Klan with anti-minority, but in this instance, they were in Irvington because of the high Catholic. They were anti-Catholic just as much. Now, he ended up there after several failed attempts to invade other areas of Indiana. He came up through Evansville, Indiana. He tried to take over, so to speak, by joining Eugene V. Debs and the Socialist Party down in Terre Haute. They got rid of him, or over in Terre Haute. They got rid of him. He went down to Evansville, and he actually ran as a congressional candidate for the Democratic Party. He lost. And decided to come up here to Indianapolis and figured out that rather than running himself, he would try to control things from behind the scenes, and that's what he did. He chose the Republican Party, and with Klan money and with Klan influence, he got just about every major Indiana official elected in 1924, 25, 26.
Is there somebody who you can compare him to at that point, or at his peak, to today?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you have to remember the times. This is the mid-1920s. Hitler's on the rise in Germany. Mussolini's on the rise in Italy. And Huey Long is on the rise down in Louisiana. All populists, all extremists, and all looking to take over despotically to achieve their goals, whatever they may be. With Stevenson, it was money, pure money. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily the power. He equated power with money. Mm-hmm. So his goals were different. He wanted the money, which to him equaled power.
He was a grand dragon. That's a specific position for the Ku Klux Klan.
He was the grand dragon. And he controlled Indiana, and he controlled 22 northern states. It could be argued that he was the most powerful man in the Midwest, some would say in the country. You have to keep in touch with what the times were. In 1925, it cost a man $10 a year to join the Klan. Stevenson retained $4 out of every $10 membership. 250,000 members in Indiana. That's over one-third of the native white male population of the state. And keep in mind, he controlled Indiana and 22 northern states. And if you need more evidence of his money, he got $3 off of every Klansman sheet that they purchased. All cash, all unreported, no income tax. Went to his head. He was a flash in the pan. He really was only at the height of his power for a couple of years.
What did he do before he was doing the Klan stuff?
Well, he used to tell people, what he told people was a lie. He told people that he came from a wealthy family. He told people that he served with honor in World War I. And that he made his money by smart investing in oil stocks. None of it's true. He came from a bunch of sharecroppers, moved from town to town. When he left Evansville, he left a wife and a child. He just left them. And he did serve technically in World War I, but he never got any further than New Jersey as a recruiting officer. But he told everybody that he was shot at and he served with honor. So that's pretty much his background. And when he came here, he was the classic snake oil salesman of the Wild West. You know, people believed him. His most distinguishing attribute, he's short little fat guy, blonde hair, blue eyes, in his mid-30s. But he had the ability to remember every name of every person that he had ever met. He had that kind of recollection, instant recollection. So that served him well, and it endeared him to people that he met.
To the point where he had so much power that he had a phone that he claimed had a direct line to the president.
Yeah, he had the entire top floor of the Kresge Building, the biggest building in Indianapolis at the time. And he occupied the whole floor. There were 12 phones going into his office alone. And remember, this is at a time when Carmel, Indiana, would have had 5 for the entire town. He had 12 in his office. One of these was a special red phone, just like Batman, a red phone that he said was the direct line to the White House. Well, he said that he could contact the White House anytime he wanted. And if you were in his office, he would pretend that he was talking to the president. Whether he was or not, no one will ever know. But when you consider the times and who the president was, it was Warren G. Harding. Warren G. Harding was a known Klansman, and Warren G. Harding was from Ohio, one of the regions that Stevenson controlled. He had strong ties to Ohio. To give you an illustration of how much money this guy had, he paid $55,000 in 1925 for one of three custom yachts. The other two owners, and this yacht was so big that no lake in Indiana could moor it. He had to take it to Lake Erie in Cleveland, Ohio. The other two owners of the yachts were R.E. Olds, the Oldsmobile family, and Al Capone. And those are the three yachts. And $55,000 is over $500,000 in today's money. So he had money. There's no question about it.
If we look back at, because on my podcast, I really make sure that we don't glorify people like D.C. Stevenson. The reason we're talking about him is because of something horrible that he did, which you will hear and you'll tell us that ultimately brought down the Klan as a whole. So we need to give homage to the lady who helped that happen. But let's tell a little bit of that story. Why don't we tell the listeners what happened in 1925 in the late winter, early spring of 1925?
Well, in 1925, Stevenson was slowly taking over the state through the political system of the Republican Party. He got the mayor of Indianapolis, a man by the name of Duval, elected. He got just about every major office holder in Indianapolis elected with his influence and Klan money. And most importantly, he got a man by the name of Ed Jackson elected governor of the state of Indiana. And keep in mind, all these men signed oaths of allegiance to D.C. Stevenson in particular and the KKK, something that would never happen today. And that was what they did. That was the deal with the devil that they made to win office. Ed Jackson, the governor, lived in Irvington. He lived on the National Road. His house is still there. It was the Philippe Insurance Agency for a long time. People pass it every day not realizing that this was a governor's mansion, so to speak. He would walk to his office every day from Irvington. That's about a 5-mile walk, and that's just the kind of guy he was. Ed Jackson was easily controllable. And he's our country's only KKK elected governor. It ended badly for him. They kicked him out of office. But that's how Stevenson came into being. He was running the state from the Indiana State House at the time. He came in contact at Ed Jackson's inaugural ball in the Indiana Athletic Club, which is kind of funny because that's always been a Democratic organization, but the Republicans had their inaugural ball in the Indiana Athletic Club. And coming through that line that night was a 28-year-old girl named Madge Oberholzer. She had been a Butler College student. She had grown up in Irvington. Her family was in Irvington. She did not graduate from Butler. It wasn't because she wasn't smart enough. She just got bored and she got left. She left the school. She got a job at the State House. So that put her in at least his sphere of influence. You know, she would have seen him on a regular basis. It's debatable on how close they were. Some people say they had just a passing acquaintance. Some people say that she went out with him a couple times. Nobody knows, but we do know that Madge was a good girl, and she wouldn't have normally been around Stevenson because Stevenson was a bad guy. He had a bad reputation as a drunk and a womanizer, and Madge wouldn't have naturally gone to him. But this is basically her boss. You know, he's in control of what she does. He had promised her that he would put her in charge of a new children's book program that he had created, where he was going to get the money. But he said, I'll put you in charge of it. Well, she had moved back to Irvington after leaving Butler into a house that her parents had bought at University in Dewey, just up the road from Stevenson Mansion, that's close to the Bonnet Thompson Center today.
And for anybody who doesn't know, Irvington and the Bonnet Thompson Center is a historical archives.
Yes.
And that's a lot of your research a lot of this information that you get, you do that research, but also you give it to Bonna to make sure that people can see it too.
Yeah. Yeah. The Irvington Historical Society makes their headquarters in the Bonna Thompson Center, and they're invaluable. Steve Barnett, Don Flick, Kent Hankins, they're all A+ historians, and they can answer anything you want on Irvington at any time.
Madge's house is right there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally right down the street.
Just on the other side of the circle. If you've been to South Irving Circle, you're within a stone's throw of Madge's house.
And Stevenson's mansion isn't too far away either.
Yeah, the circle pretty much bisects it. So point of reference, if you know where the Children's Guardian School was, you know where Madge's house is. When she had moved back in, her parents were just normal people. They weren't wealthy people. They'd had jobs at Union Station. And Madge was making a little bit of money. She was making about $6,500 in 1925. That's a lot of money. That's a salary akin to about $75,000. And he had promised that he would pay her more in charge of this book program. And she said, okay, because, you know, I'm trying to help my parents out. I moved back in here to help them out with the bills so they could use the money more than I can use the money. So she kind of hung on the promise that she was going to be elevated in her employment position. What had happened on the night of Sunday, March 15, 1925, Stevenson had met this girl, had hit on this girl, had asked her out, and Madge completely turned him down. That night he had had enough, decided he was going to get her one way or another. And on that night, about 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, he called that house from his Stevenson mansion, and he said, I'm leaving for Chicago tomorrow morning. I need you to come here and take dictation on this book program so that we can get this rolling. She agreed. He sent a bodyguard down to pick her up, and the bodyguard knocked on the door, escorted Madge right back down the road to Stevenson mansion. She went into the mansion, and she knew she was in trouble immediately. She's a 28-year-old girl alone with three men, and Stevenson was roaring drunk. He had no intention of getting down to business, but Madge did. Madge got out her steno pad, she sat down, and she wanted to get to work. He is trying to get her to drink. She doesn't drink. Remember, drinking is illegal. This is prohibition. Alcohol is illegal. Doesn't matter. He was trying to get her to drink. She kept refusing him. Finally, she agreed to drink a soda pop, and he put drugs in this soda pop, what we would call date rape drugs. She didn't know. She drank the soda pop, and he waited for the drugs to take effect. When they did, he grabbed Madge, and along with his bodyguards, they went down to Union Station, and they boarded that train bound for Chicago that he had talked about earlier. He went into a Pullman berth, which is an old-fashioned private car that has bunk beds basically covered by, where the doors are basically curtains. There's not much privacy. Bodyguard got into the upper berth. Stevenson pushed Madge into the lower berth. And for the train trip up to Chicago, he did terrible, terrible things to this young girl. He attacked her. The train pulled into Hammond, Indiana. And that's where they stopped. They didn't make it to Chicago. He checked into the City Hotel in Hammond, Indiana.
Why? You know why.
He didn't want to take her across state lines. That would have been a violation of the Mann Act, which is a federal crime. It's still a state crime to go from Indianapolis to Hammond.
It's one of the main reasons Dillinger got caught pursued by the FBI.
And more recently, Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry served time in federal prison for that exact offense in the 60s. So it's still...
More recently in the 60s.
Well, you know, that shows our age. It's more recently to me. I can remember the 60s. The 60s are ancient history to you.
So he was smart enough to know not to do that.
Yeah.
And save his own butt, essentially.
Exactly.
But he was doing really...
Yeah, he checked in. They checked into rooms 415 and 416, I believe, as Mr. and Mrs. Morgan. And his bodyguards were in one room, he and Madge were in the other, and he continued to attack her all night long. Remember, she's drugged. She can't do anything to stop it. She's powerless. She knows what's going on, but she can't help herself. She wakes up the next morning. The drugs had worn off. She realized what had happened to her. She's distraught because it was terrible. It was terrible what he did to this young girl. She woke up. She realized she had to get away. She asked to be released. She asked to phone her phone back to her parents. She'd never been away all night without them knowing where she's at. He did not let her do any of that. I'm going to keep you as long as I want, and you're not calling your parents. So she came up with the plan. How do I get away from this guy? She asked to be taken to a drugstore in Hammond, Indiana, and she said, I'm a mess. I need makeup, and I need a hat. Stevenson sent one of his bodyguards. He's hungover. He doesn't care. He's not paying much attention. throws a $5 bill at his bodyguard, said, get her out of here, take her to the drugstore. This man by the name of Shorty took her to the drugstore. She bought the makeup, she bought the hat, but she also slipped away and she bought a bottle of mercury bichloride tablets, which you could buy over the counter back then. It was made by Eli Lilly, as a matter of fact. And she went back to the hotel room. Why did they sell mercury over the counter? Because they can't do it now. I mean, if they find mercury in Indiana now, they call the hazmat guys off and fence it off like a crime scene. But back then, women bought it to clean sealskin capes, which was the fashion statement for women back then. And Madge is a college girl. And she may have heard the rumors that made the rounds on the college campuses that if you mixed water with this, you could use it as kind of a topical morning after solution. We don't know why she bought it. We know what she did with it. She went back to the hotel room. She locked herself in the bathroom and she lined the contents, which were 18 tablets, 18 little blue tablets on the sink ledge, and she began to take them three at a time. She managed to choke down six of them before she began to cough up clots of blood and actual pieces of her intestinal lining. She fell away on the floor with a thud. Now, keep in mind, six tablets of mercury bichloride would be like six teaspoons of Drano, would have the same effect. Awful. Mm. Awful. They came in, one of the bodyguards, and Stevenson woke up Stevenson, whom he called the old man. That's what everybody called D.C. Stevenson.
Even though he was like 32, yeah. 35.
Yes, yes.
Which wasn't, you know.
Yeah. He's in his mid-30s. I want to say 34. I try not to linger on Stevenson too much because although he is a fascinating character, he is a forgettable man in my eyes. I'd rather focus on Madge Oberholzer.
Thank you. And this is why I want you with me. This because that same philosophy is what I try to do here.
It's the victim.
It's important.
It's the victim. It's not the perpetrator.
Right.
You know, the perpetrator is dealing with his own demons someplace else, and I'd like to think he's still dealing with his own demons. It's the innocent victim that I'd prefer to talk about. It's the innocent victim that I'd spend more time researching and speaking of. Because Stevenson is just Stevenson. He's a bad dude, and there's nothing good about him. Some people liked him because he could charm you, but he was not a likable man in my book.
Not to mention, Madge is just doing something that what we call today, in the sense of a Me Too movement, she was doing it in her own way in 1925, which is absolutely commendable and should be remembered. Should be remembered.
Very smart girl. Very smart girl. And if you go back and you read what her fellow classmates had to say about her in the yearbook, they all loved her. And what I take away from Madge is that they said that when she spoke, her voice sounded exactly like Betty Boop, which I love. I love that's an image to me that it screams a sweet, nice girl to me. And she was far ahead of her time. One of the things she did before she died and right after she left school was she had started this job and she was making enough money where she could get a pretty nice car. So she went out and bought a new car. And she and a girlfriend drove it all the way out to California and back to Indiana by themselves. And keep in mind, this is in the early 20s, and there's no roads. Most of the roads are dirt roads, plank roads. I mean, I've written two books on the National Road. I'm not just all ghost all the time.
Yeah.
And the roads were brutal back then. In the teens and 20s, they were brutal. And she did this. That's the type of person she was. Now, the aftermath of what happened to her after she took this poison, Stevenson came walking into that bathroom. He saw her laying on the floor. The bodyguards, by now there's two of them, are panicked because she's obviously messed up. They could see what had happened and what she had done, and they were nervous. He wasn't upset at all. He said, this is not a problem. And what they recall him saying is, this is no big deal. I am the law in Indiana. And he was. He ran everything. He had done this before. He had a history of doing this before and covering it up. So it was no big deal to him. He ordered his bodyguards to go and get a car. They rented a car and they took Madge and they put her in the back seat and they drove her back to Irvington. There is a carriage house behind that house on University Avenue that's still there today. There must be a ghost in the room, Joe.
Well, that would be the first time anything ever happened to us. The microphone just tipped down
just
a little.
Just tipped down, yeah. This carriage house is still behind this house in the Stevenson Mansion in Irvington, and he took her back there. It is a converted horse and buggy house. It's got three doors, and it had a tack room up at top. Now it's an apartment. They took Madge and they put her into this tack room. But more importantly, as they're driving home, Madge is resting on the back seat on the floorboard. She's vomiting into the floorboard as Stevenson and his bodyguard rest with their feet on her back, drinking alcohol from brown paper bags. She is begging to be released. She is begging to be taken to the hospital. Take me to the farmhouse. Drop me in the ditch. Anything. They refuse. She keeps saying, it burns, it burns, it burns. And they remember her saying that, I want a hypodermic for the pain. That's what how you administered pain medicine back then. They refused. They took her back down to that carriage house. They walked her upstairs and they put her in the center of the room. And for 9 hours, D.C. Stevenson paced around her, screaming, you must marry me. Every time she said no, no, no. Why did he say that? He believed falsely that a wife could not testify against her husband. That's not true, but that's what he believed. Finally, he said, get her out of here. Ordered one of his bodyguards to take her home to that house. They called the Oberholzer house. They told the mother and father to come get your daughter at Union Station. Why? To get him out of the house. They went down. The bodyguard, a man by the name of Clink, Earl Clink, took her down, walked her in the back door and dropped her in her bed, her upstairs bedroom, and he fled. He was spotted by one of the boarders. He ran out the door without really answering any questions. He said, call a doctor. This woman's been in an automobile accident, and ran out the door. The boarder called the Oberholzer family. Get back here. They said, call a local doctor. If she's sick, she needs help. So they called a man by the name of Dr. John Kingsbury. Very famous Irvington physician, practiced there for 50 years. Kingsbury came up there. He examined Madge, and what he discovered was she had dozens, maybe as many as 100, bite marks all over her body, from her ankle all the way up to her cheek, all inflicted by Stevenson during that attack. One of them was very, very severe. One of them left lasting damage to her body. They knew right away that she wasn't going to make it, and they knew Stevenson well enough to know that he's going to delay that trial until that girl's dead so that she can't testify against him. So Kingsbury asked another Irvingtonian, a man by the name of Asa J. Smith, a young lawyer.
One of your heroes.
One of my heroes in life.
And I remember. I listened.
One of my heroes in life, and why is he a hero? He was an atheist. That's not why he's a hero. It's the way he handled it. Mm-hmm. When he would meet a preacher, because he did a lot in that, he was an army officer, a lawyer, he would ask them, so what branch of the superstition do you adhere to? I think that's one of the greatest lines I've ever heard. So a very smart man, served with honor in both wars, World War I and World War II. He came up there and he got a young girl to come up and take her deathbed declaration, her being Madge Oberholzer's deathbed declaration. They knew she wasn't going to make it to trial. Remember, she'd been drugged, but she remembered everything that happened to her. She just was powerless to keep it from happening. So it turned out to be 9 pages long. It was very graphic, very detailed. She spoke of what happened to her in terms that people didn't normally listen to. It was so graphic that when it was read aloud in open court in Noblesville, Indiana, in the courthouse that is still in Noblesville, that courthouse, when it was read aloud, women fainted and grown men got up and left the room. It was graphic. And what we've done lately is last year and this year, October, this year it will be Saturday, October 19th, and this is a little shameless plug. We do a talk called Whispers from the Grave with a lot of local media personalities that have become friends of mine over the years. And Channel 13's Nicole Masensic will read Madge's testimony. Last year she read it, and it was the first time since 1925 that it had been read aloud. And you'll be able to hear the second time if you come Saturday, October 19th. It's free. So anybody can come.
Say it again. What's the date again?
Saturday, October 19th.
Great.
Probably about 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the Irving Theater.
Yeah.
So come and Dave Wilson's going to read the part of D.C. Stevenson. Everybody remembers Dave as the king. Ed Wink is going to do H.H. Holmes. Julie Patterson will do Georgiana Yoke. It's very interesting. They're reading testimony. And we talked earlier about the things that I don't get to talk about on the tour. Yeah. And you can't believe what these people actually said until you hear it in their own words. And then you're just like, wow, this is amazing. You know, that's the great thing about Irvington Ghost Tours is it actually happened. You know, what has changed in the 17 years that I've done these tours is it used to be people would come out and they would want to hear the stories and they would go home, go to the libraries, go to the newspapers and look them up. Now the kids Google them on their phone. You know,
probably
they're right there.
Speaking.
They're fact checking me and I can see it in their faces. They're like waiting for me to make a mistake, but everything I'm telling them, it's right there. It's right there. Sometimes the story's enough, Joe. Sometimes you don't need to have a ghost story attached to it. And with this instance, the story's enough. Madge lived for 30 days. She died on tax day, April 15th, 1925. What makes Irvington special is the groundbreaking things that happened there. As you said, Madge was a Me Too girl before there were Me Too girls. And if you are interested in all the forensics, and I know you are, mm-hmm. my wife is, everybody, you turn on TV, it's always forensics. Well, for the first time in Indiana history, they discovered at that trial that even though Madge had taken all that mercury, that's not what killed her. For the first time in Indiana history, it was proven forensically that it was one of the bite marks to her body that caused a staph infection to set into her bloodstream, and that is what killed her. She would have survived the mercury poisoning because she was vomiting. So for the first time, someone was convicted on forensic evidence, mm-hmm. which makes it Madge's case especially interesting. Stevenson was convicted of second-degree murder, sentenced to 28 years in prison. Still to this day, the longest sentence ever served for that crime in this state. While he was there, he made threats because he had gotten all these powerful men elected, some of whom were still in positions of power. And he said, I'm going to release these documents and I'm going to ruin your career if you don't give me privileges and let me out early. In an effort to get him to shut up, Governor Harold Hanley decided, I'll let you out if you shut up and don't leave the state. Well, the first thing he did was leave the state. He fled to Johnson.
He's a liar and a terrible person.
Absolutely. And he looked like Captain Kangaroo by the time they let him out. But he was bad to
almost
the
like
core. Almost
like Dustin Hoffman and Hook when you take off his wig. He's just an old man, sad old man, as
exactly.
they said in that movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he went down to Johnson City, Tennessee, and he attacked another young girl. And he died there. He's buried there, which makes me happy because he's not buried in Indiana. A lot of the people that were connected to him came to unlikely demises. So he was just a bad guy, and so was everybody that was around him.
Two bodyguards, you said.
Earl Gentry and Earl Klink. Klink was a former sheriff of Evansville, Indiana. He just disappeared. After the trial, no one knows what happened to him. I've researched him all over the place, and I can't find him. He just disappeared. Earl Gentry, the other bodyguard, fled to Wisconsin, and he was murdered. He got his mistress had him murdered. So Stevenson was just a bad, bad guy, and that's why I don't focus on him. Madge is the one to remember. And Madge is important because when Madge died on April 15, 1925, the Klan died with her. And she's a hero in my eyes because without Madge, the Klan was the most powerful organization in the country. It was powerful and getting more powerful. Stevenson's crime brought the Klan to its knees. The membership was never the same after the Madge Oberholzer crime.
And it's because the image of the Ku Klux Klan leader was demolished?
It's because the Klan principles, every one of the Klan principles that they touted as this is what we, one of their main edicts is that you treat women with respect. That's one of the main edicts of being a Klansman. Another is you don't drink. Another is you lead a very moralistic life. He broke all of them. Most importantly was he did not uphold the sanctity of womanhood, which was very important to the Klan. And once he did that, people realized that this guy's just another dude out there trying to make a buck, and he's a criminal. He might as well have a gun or a knife and be down on the corner sticking people up. There's no difference. It's just one's in a suit and one wears a mask.
Selling snake oil.
Yeah. He was a bad dude. Stevenson is a bad dude.
So Madge is the one we need to remember. Mm-hmm. This is she's the one. If you want information, I'm sure there's information online, but also you've written articles about.
I have. I've written articles about this. I've written about them in several of my books. I'm up to about 7 or 8. I'm working on 5 more books as we speak.
Another shameless plug.
Yeah, another shameless plug. And while we're on shameless plugs, there's a friend of mine who is connected to the Irvington Historical Society, Char Flick. Is writing a detailed biography of Madge.
Oh, great.
And that will be the first time that story's heard. So we're anxious to see that. And she's researching it and talking to the surviving family members and that sort of thing.
So what do you think the most important aspect of this story that people need to remember about true crime? Because I really drive home the fact that true crime affects, it's a ripple effect of through time. Of these horrible events, but they're not just the events themselves, but it's the people that are affected, communities, Madge's family, all of them were really the center of the aftermath of all this. Yeah, Stevenson went away and then ended up, you know, doing what he did, but the point is there's a lesson to be learned here. Even back then, what do you think that is?
Well, Stevenson was the forerunner of guys like Ted Bundy. Stevenson would come at you with a smile, come at you, he had a good job, he had a good career, he had power. He was, if you took him at face value, you were likely to fall into his trap. And so you need to remain vigilant. The reason that I do these tours is to, in a small way, because I get kids on my tours all the time. I'm an ex-teacher, you know, and if I can tell you a ghost story or a crime story to get you interested in history and that you can walk away and learn a lesson from, well, then all the better for me. That's why I do it. And from my standpoint, you know, there's this community, this society, it lives in an information age. And even in this information age, people still slip through the cracks, and they still come at you with a smile on their face or a promise of this or the promise of that. I mean, you need to remain vigilant. You need to vet everybody that comes into your circle and get to the point where you're not comfortable enough to let your guard completely down. Mm. With Madge, I don't know what she could have done differently to extricate herself from the situation she found herself in any more than I can. Most of these Me Too victims, you know, the problem that they have is believability. Well, you should believe them all. You know, you should believe them all. You start from there. You don't start questioning why are they here. You start at the accusation and you work backwards. You don't start at the character and work forwards. And with Madge, her character was sterling. His character was bad. Unfortunately, he did a terrible thing to this young girl. But had he not gone too far, maybe he would have gotten away with it. You know, maybe he would have attacked another girl.
Well, so he did, yeah. And he did.
He did,
prior,
and he did.
And then,
but we didn't know about those until after the bad thing happened to Madge. So you just remain vigilant.
Strong woman who took it into her own hands. Unfortunately, she almost tried to kill herself in order to get the point across that this guy is a bad dude.
Yes.
Because that's what she was emotionally distraught, and that's part of it. But I believe that she was doing it to bring him down because she knew what the repercussions would have been.
Yes, and you know, there's a certain amount of shame involved And it's displaced shame. There was nothing for her to be ashamed of. She didn't do anything wrong. But still there's that stigma that was attached to it, even more so than it is today. It's that people are going to start questioning her, just like they question victims now. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't act. You shouldn't. You should look at the bad thing for what it is. It's a bad thing. It's not, okay, well, how did this happen? Doesn't matter how it happened. It happened. And that's the case of the mad, that is the moral of the mad story. She could not have done anything to get herself out of this situation.
And like you said, recognizing, being vigilant. I mean, I think you know better than anybody. We've talked about this. You have come face to face with a serial killer. You've met a serial killer.
Yeah, Herb Baumeister, absolutely. And you know, he was pretty easy to spot because he was kind of an odd duck to begin with. But even though, you know, you can't just blindly judge somebody. Mm. That's just as bad as anything you can do. But I've seen it, and Herb would have been the last person that I would have ever suspected of doing what he did. And not only
He helped you out on the baseball field. I mean, you know, he looked like a good parent.
Yeah, that's what I did. I taught high school and I coached high school baseball. And in that capacity at Westfield High School, and lived in Carmel. Herb lived in Carmel, just two streets away from me at Fox Hollow Farm. He showed up in the summertime. Generally, you're a coach. You know what it's like. You know, everybody wants to come watch the games. Nobody wants to come practice and help you out when you're practicing. So you've got to juggle all these bats and balls yourself. Well, he showed up, and he noticed that I did not have a first base coach. And he said, "Do you need somebody on first base?" I said, "Sure." I hadn't seen him before. And he was wearing a three-piece suit and penny loafers. And I said, "Sure, if you want to coach first base, that's great." So he went over there, and it's just basically making sure the kids don't get hurt. You know, it's not really coaching. It's just don't get hurt.
Yeah, or at least telling them to go when there's an overthrow.
Yeah, foul ball, that sort of thing. Obvious things that anybody can do. And so he did, and he said, "Well, do you need somebody to help you next time?" I said, "Sure, if you want to come out, come on out." Came out next time and asked me he minded if he hit fly balls to the outfielders during practice. I said, "Absolutely." So here I've got this image of this guy, who you've seen him. He's, you know, he's got this toupee-looking hair.
Lanky.
Yeah, lanky, and he's
pale.
In a three-piece suit with penny loafers trying to hit fly balls to my outfield.
There it is, trying.
So I went from worrying about my kids getting hurt to worrying about Herb getting hurt. I was shocked, and so was my wife, that years later, this was the dude. This was the guy that did all this stuff. And you know as well as I do, he's probably did a heck of a lot more than they pin on him.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And go back to one of my episodes, and you can listen to that.
You'll hear it, yeah.
The Virgil Vandegrift episode. He's the investigator that caught him, or at least helped catch him. Let's get credit to where credit's due, the missing persons department at IMPD, but also the Hamilton County Sheriff's too.
Yeah.
Had a play to part.
And one of the officers lives in Irvington.
Yeah.
One of the officers does.
So just a lesson from someone who knows history better than anybody I've ever met. You are seriously one of the most.
I'm a pop culturalist. that's what it is. There's. In history, what you find is you have highbrow and you have lowbrow. I'm decidedly lowbrow and proud of it.
There will be more with Al that you'll be able to hear. Where can people read some of your books? Where can people read some of your articles? I think those would be very interesting.
You can go to the Weekly View newspaper every week. It's a weekly newspaper based in Irvington and on the east side of Indianapolis, from Indianapolis all the way to Greenfield. My column's on the front page. It's called Bumps in the Night. And I write about the things that I think people want to hear about. One week it might be the Beatles. The next it might be ghosts. The next it might be... This week it's on one of the Dillinger gang members, a guy by the name of Red Hamilton. And it's worth a read. It's two parts. So I tell you the story and then I tell you the end.
And where do you get the information? I think that should be, I think you should tell people because that's interesting.
Any of the green, bright green kiosks that you see on the east side, you go, the paper's free, so you can pick it up. Or you can go to the net and go to the Weekly View. I believe it's .net. or .org, but just type in Weekly View, you'll see it. And mm-hmm. I write with a bunch of different interesting writers. It's not just me. You know, C.J. Wood, Steve Barnett from the Irvington Historic Society writes there. It's all good reading. And if you've noticed, newspapers aren't around much anymore. They're dying by the month. Well, we're still there, and we'd appreciate it if you'd pick up a copy and read it.
Wonderful.
Now, as far as my books, yes. I won't sell you a book. That's not what I'm about. I want you to come on a tour in October, and I'll give you a book. You come buy a ticket. I'll put a book in your hand. It will go into the details of the stories that you can go home and take it home and read in detail. Because like you and I talked about, things like this give me a chance to go into certain areas that I don't have time to talk about on the tours. And that's true of every story I tell, whether I'm talking about Dillinger, whether I'm talking about Stevenson and Madge Oberholtzer, or Abraham Lincoln, it does not matter. There's more out there in Irvington than you realize. Plus, you know, you might run into Charlie Manson, you might run into Jim Jones, and you might run into Herb Baumeister in Irvington. You just got to come on a tour and take your chances.
Don't say that. Oh man, you're great. Again, everybody, if you want more information, I'll put it on infamousindy.com. Al, like always, man, I'm just very honored and thankful.
Well, I'll tell you something that's going to pique your interest. Last night I had dinner, or the other night when we this is our second time that we've done
this.
Let's be straight. We did this once before and it didn't take, so this is take two. But right after that first take, I went down to Giacomo's Pizza and had a four-hour dinner with the original criminalist on one of the crimes in Irvington on the D.C. Stevenson estate. Had dinner with him. So, you know, one of these days you'll have to have him on your show too.
I will. And we'll continue to grow. This won't be the last time, hopefully. You know, as long as you're willing, and we'll do it in one take, I promise.
Yeah.
And we got it now. We figured it out. So
there you go.
If you guys want to learn more, I'll put more on infamousindy.com, and you'll hear more from Al. I want to bring you on for Abraham Lincoln.
There you go.
I think Indiana has that connection.
Well, you're surrounded by him.
I am surrounded by him. You have some. I'm looking at a letter that he wrote.
Right up there is Abe Lincoln's ice skate, Joe. Abe Lincoln's candle mold.
His Bible.
Yeah, his Bible's right behind you.
So
it's you never can tell what you're going to find when you come into my office.
And on the tours as well. You do switch him up too.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Well, because I'm always learning. You know, I try to go out and I'm not just one dimensional. I'm really interested in what I'm doing. And I try, if I get new tidbits, that's why I had dinner with the criminalist. You know, and he told me new things that I... about a different crime that took place on D.C. Stevenson's property. He was there and he confirmed everything I've been talking about and more.
Wonderful. Well, head out. Sir, thank you very much. Yep. And as always, I say in the podcast, I end it, stay safe. Again, thanks for joining me, everybody. I really appreciate your time. And wherever you are in the world, be safe and vigilant. Also, go to infamousindy.com, the Infamous Indy Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and comment, like, and share. And coming up soon is the Indie Pop Con. It's very podcast-centric, so go check them out. See if you can get a ticket. And come down to downtown Indianapolis, the Convention Center, and check it out. I'm going to be there Friday. I put the podcast in for an award. So let's see if we win. I mean, I only had 80 episodes when I put it in, so I doubt I'm going to win. But if I see you there, make sure to say hi. I'm going to also try to do a live recording on their podcast stage that day. So I'm going to try to set up an interview to do that. So anyway, happy Memorial Day, everybody. Enjoy, get some sun, and eat some hot dogs, and say the Pledge of Allegiance, and thank a veteran somewhere, some way. Again, thanks, everybody, and stay safe.